July 2002. Retired NBA star Bison Delly and his girlfriend Serena Carlin disappear while on a sailing trip from French Polynesia to Hawaii, along with the catamaran's captain, Bertrand Seldo. An investigation spanning two sides of the Pacific ensues, but 20 years on, questions remain. Primary sources for this episode include sportscasting.com, ESPN, Sports Illustrated, the National Park Service, and NBA Insider. Hey guys, welcome back to episode 135, part one of Unknown Passage, a podcast that tells the stories of those who have gone missing or have been murdered abroad. I was going to hold on to start this series till next week, but I kind of felt a bit of a calling to record it tonight for you guys, at least to kick it off, and then part two will be out next week. But first off, I want to say welcome to new patron Josh, who came on board this week, so welcome. Now, I'm going to get straight into this, and it will be a two-part episode. And first of all, I want to say that this will take us back into NBA territory, which was terrifying to me personally. But then I started to have a bit of a thought. So this is about a retired NBA star, Bison Delly, who once upon a time went by the name Brian Williams, who disappeared with his girlfriend and their ship's captain in 2002. This year, in July, next month, will be 20 years. When I was a little girl, Australia is really behind in terms of getting things, TV, movies, until Netflix. Movies came out here like a year after everywhere else in the world. But my dad had a little black and white TV, no shit, it wasn't the 50s, it was the 90s. And when we used to stay at his house, at 6 o'clock every morning, we'd be up super early, me and my older brother. And we loved NBA. And we would watch NBA at 6 in the morning, that's when it would be on a random channel on Australian TV. We'd watch it on a black and white TV. We were mad about it. We're mad about it to the point where we all had jerseys of our own teams, but we never actually got to see a game, and I've never seen one, and I've never been to the States either. So I went for Orlando Magic. My dad went for Charlotte Hornets, and I'm not even sure they're still a team. Let me know. My brother went for Chicago Bulls, and to the point where my little brother is named Jordan after Michael Jordan because he was born on the 23rd, which is Michael Jordan's number, and my older brother got to name him. So that was my connection as far as NBA to this. But then I had a thought right before I started recording this. My thought was, I bet I watched Bison Delly play basketball when I was a little girl, quite unhappy when my parents split up, and it gave me a lot of joy. One of the few things that did when I would have to stay at my dad's house and be away from home, which was with my mum. And I would look forward to NBA so much, and it just took me back, you know, just for that couple of hours that it would be aired on Aussie TV. I felt like it took me away from all the worries in my head. And we probably watched Bison Delly, and here I am 25 years on from that, 30 years on from that. Me talking about his disappearance and him having been disappeared for 20 years this year. And I just thought life is strange in that way. I just had that random thought. First off, before I get into this week's case, I want to say a shout out to ESPN for their coverage in 2002 of this story. It was quite early on in the piece when they didn't really have proper answers, or there hadn't been a lot of time for it to kind of mellow a little bit after all was said and done. That piece was called Paradise Lost, and I will use it, although I did find a lot of it extremely judgmental, which I'll get into. Particular shout out to Sports Illustrated. Yes, I read Sports Illustrated for the articles this time. for their piece from 2013 called Lost Soul by Chris Ballard. It was brilliant. It helped immensely with this. And I never thought I'd say that about Sports Illustrated. Now, if you know this case, the reason that I'm doing it is because it's a patron location request for French Polynesia for Claire from Nova Scotia. And I'll talk about her in a minute. But if you don't know the case, try not to look on the internet for part two and what happens in that, because there's so many twists and turns you just won't see coming if you don't know it. But I held off on doing this case. I didn't want to do it because I'd seen it covered by so many shows. And I don't like to do stories that have been done a million times, as you know, but I also don't like to do ones that I feel like I can't add anything new to it. But then it occurred to me that all these 10-minute YouTuber fluff pieces that are just designed to get clicks and are not about the person at all, of course I can add more to that. And I did. I found a lot of resources that talked about who these actual people were. And I started to really relate to these people. Parts of it made me very emotional. And it just shows that someone who can have all the money in the world and live a life that's the opposite of the one you're living, on the other side of the world, you can find empathy and compassion for people no matter what and things in common. But I also just want to give a warning that two of the main people in this story have two different names in this story. So I will start with their original names, and when they change their names, I will let you know. So this is a Patreon location request for Claire from Nova Scotia in Canada. I hope it's a little bit warmer up there for you at this time of year, Claire. Now, she requested Belize initially, which I already had on the list for someone else, and that is coming up. Strange fact, Belize is probably my most requested place, and I only have like one or two cases available there, so I've been holding off on doing them. But then I said, can you give me another option, which sometimes happens, and it was French Polynesia that she gave me. But I did want to say that she told me something really cool about her time spent in Belize. And she said, quote, one of your episodes, you said we'd go to Belize sometime. And I know we were having issues finding a location for me, so you can do Belize if you like. In university, I did a 2-week volunteer trip there, and it holds a special place in my heart. I lived and worked at the zoo for a few days, and then the rest of the time I lived in a Mayan village and helped with painting the school and repairing some thatch roofs, unquote. Which is just super cool, and it's a story that you'll, you know, remember for the rest of your life. But as we have Belize coming up, I went for her next option, French Polynesia. And looking at my massive spreadsheet, dropping down to F, the only one that I could find in French Polynesia was the one that I'd put off doing, Bison Deli and Serena Carlin. A case many of you have probably seen covered before, and I hope that I can contribute something new for you on this two-parter. Bison Deli, and I want to say that people say his surname differently. This was his new name that he took on when he was about 30 years old. I think it's French. I will get into where I've looked up where it comes from, which I hadn't seen done before. In French, it would probably be Deli. Americans seem to say daily in their coverage, or there's a number of different ways to say it. And then some say Deli. So I've just decided to go with Deli. He was a retired NBA player, our second for the show, unbelievably, who have vanished abroad. The first one was an episode, a double episode I'm really proud of, that I did way back towards the start of the podcast about John Briska. It's one of my least listened to episodes, and I don't know how else to put this, but looking at my analytics, my least listened to episodes are all people who are minorities, usually black males. And I don't know if that's that's just a thing. It's usually Asian and black males. And then my top ranking ones are Chris and Lisanne Froon and all these kind of, you know, white women. So please, if you haven't listened to them, take the time to go back and listen, because their stories are really important. And I was really proud of the John Briska coverage that I did. He was a retired NBA player, albeit decades before Bison Deli, who went missing in Uganda, where he had gone to kind of go and find his roots because he was very lost in the NBA and after he left. And there are so many similarities between John Briska and Bison Deli. I can't even begin to fathom it. It just blew me away as I was researching Bison again. Bison and his girlfriend Serena Carlin vanished at sea near Tahiti in 2002, along with their skipper Bertrand Saldo, who is never talked about. I have his date of birth and his nationality, and that is it. and he will come into the second part of this episode. Serena Carlin is barely ever touched on by most sources. It's purely just about Bison for most people. So I've made a point of researching Serena, and I'd like to thank Sports Illustrated, my new favourite publication, for talking about Serena as a person as well, because she also went missing and neither of them have ever been found. But this story is not simple. There are twists and turns in the story that are unbelievably diabolical. And I think that's what makes this case so unique to the rest of the ones that I have covered. So for part one, we are going to talk about Bison, his life, Serena and her life, and what brought them together. And this will really set the scene for part two. Bison Daly was actually born Brian Carson Williams in Fresno, California on April 6, 1969, which that year was Easter Sunday. I will call him Brian Williams for probably half of this episode because that was the name he went by for the first about 30 years of his life. And I understand Brian Williams, I think he's a famous news anchor over there. I think he's the dad of the girl from the show Girls. Anyway, this is a different Brian Williams. I'm sure there's a million Brian Williams out there. Brian Williams, the basketballer, his parents were Patricia Phillips and Eugene Williams Jr. Now, Eugene, his dad, went by Gino. That's the name I'll refer to him as. And he was a member of the musical group The Platters, which a lot of you will probably know from their songs The Great Pretender and Only You, which is one of my favourite songs of all time. I'm pretty daggy in terms of I love 50s and 60s. That's my main area of music that I love. And The Platters is their classic. This is the music I grew up on, and I have really fond memories of my mum dancing around singing Only You by The Platters. And they're technically an early rock and roll band, but they were very definitive for their time, and they had quite an interesting lineup in terms of it was four men and a woman, but they regularly kind of changed out their members. There was a lot of infighting, I believe. But in terms of harmonizing, they're just incredible. And the actor Richard E. Grant, his wife died probably about 6 months ago of many decades. And he put up just this heartbreaking clip of him dancing with his wife to the song Only You as the announcement that she died. And it was just heartbreaking. And I'll play you a little bit of Only You now just to get an idea of, you know, what Gino sang in. He was one of the kind of members of The Platters that came along a little bit later. Only you can make all this world seem right. Only you can make the darkness bright. Proper music where it was just their voice. They were incredible. Them and the Righteous Brothers, their voices are incredible. And if you ever want to watch some old clips of music, watch the Platters performing that live and how they harmonize together. It's just beautiful. So Gino, Brian Williams' dad, was one of the Platters, and he would also go on to, he'd sing with them for 18 years, but he also sang with a band called The Coasters, which I've never heard of. Now, back then, every single band started with the Righteous Brothers, the Shirelles, the Temptations, the Platters, the Drifters. So Gino Jr. was the son of Eugene Williams Sr., who was actually a well-known pianist in Fresno, and the whole family came from Fresno, which is in Central California. And he was also the son of a Baptist singer who was well known in Fresno as well. So music was in the veins of the Williams family from way back. Gino and Patricia, Brian Williams's parents, married when, according to Sports Illustrated, Patricia was a teenager, which was more of the norm back then. I don't think she was a Priscilla Presley 14. She may have been 16 or 17. So music was in the veins of this family, and Fresno was home to this family. Fresno is a city now of about 500,000 people located in Central California. When Gino Williams was 25, he and his wife Patricia welcomed their first son Kevin into the world, and 3 years later they had another son, Brian, who would go on to be known as Bison later in his career. But neither Kevin nor Brian, despite Brian seemingly having some rhythm and some musical interest, would pursue music as either of their careers. In fact, these two brothers could not have been more similar but more different, and I don't know how else to put that, so that's just how I wrote it. And I personally completely understand. Reading about these two, thanks to Sports Illustrated and ESPN, and finally getting a bit more background that wasn't just like kind of shallow coverage like on the Disappeared episode, which I did not rewatch, made me understand so much more, that they were constantly butting heads, I believe, because they saw each other as opponents, but in fact they were the same. And I understand that. When Brian and Kevin were young, their parents divorced, and Gino was regularly away touring with different bands, including the Platters, while his mum stayed in Fresno and she looked after the boys. According to Sports Illustrated, she remarried a man called Ron, who was verbally abusive and regularly berated the boys. When Brian was in junior high and Kevin was in, I guess, middle school, that marriage also ended in divorce. Ultimately, Gino would die in 2008 at the age of 64 of pancreatic cancer, probably from a very hard life lived, 6 years after his son Brian would go missing in French Polynesia. His find a grave listing states that, quote, Williams is preceded in death by his sons Kevin and Brian Williams, unquote, which, if you didn't know the story behind this, you would just see that kind of eulogy and go, oh, that's so sad. This man had lost both his sons by the time he died, and there's so much more to that story than that. So the family would move to Santa Monica for a time, where Brian actually was a top track and field athlete, but by this stage he hadn't filled out like his body like he ultimately would. By the time Brian was in high school and Kevin had graduated, the family had moved to Las Vegas. At this time, Brian would experience a massive growth spurt, and this would push him towards basketball. He played high school basketball and excelled, and he was a standout from early on, but it seemed that basketball was never really his true love. And much like his brother, he didn't know who he was or where he stood, although to me, Brian seems a little bit more sure of himself than his brother, Kevin. To describe Brian, he is a massive guy. He was 6'11", 260 pounds, which is around 118 kilos. He had kind of, his parents are both black, but he was kind of like almost light-skinned, a massive thick neck, shaved head, very intense eyes that were green. He's just such a striking-looking guy beyond his height. And when they said he had a massive growth spurt and he became 6'11", I don't know if any of you guys got this, but I'm 5'10", which is really tall for a girl, and I have not grown since I was about 12. And when I was about 10 and 11, I had the worst growing pains in my legs. I would be up all night writhing in pain. My mum would rub my legs and put heat packs on them. And all I could think was, can you imagine the growing pains that this guy went through? I just cannot. Both of Brian's parents were African American, but further back in their family lineage was Cherokee Native American. And you can definitely tell that looking at pictures of both the brothers. And as adults, they were pretty much almost identical, except later on, I'll read you a quote from Sports Illustrated, which is a bit backhanded towards Kevin, basically saying he's the uglier version. Brian was also left-handed, so shout out to left-handers because I am too. There's no shortage of photos of Brian Williams throughout his basketball career online if you'd like to go take a look, and I'll put a few on his episode page on unknownpassagepodcast.com as well as in the Patreon. His brother Kevin, on the other hand, was not an athlete, but Kevin was not, that was not for lack of probably skill or height. Kevin was 6'8". These are massive guys, and he was 260 pounds just like Brian was. He suffered, though, unfortunately, from the time he was a young boy from severe asthma. And instead of being active and getting into track, and Brian was so popular with girls and people gravitated towards him, his brother Kevin was very introverted, and ESPN refers to him as a loner, which I do not like that name, that word in general. It's thrown around too much, and often they just use it at, to interchange it with introvert, and the two things are very, very different things, and it annoys me because the use of the word loner, they use it in reference to the kid who just shot up the school in Texas. They refer to it for the Columbine kids. And most people who are loners, I just don't like the use of that term. I would rather just say someone was introverted or liked to keep to themselves, because not everyone is the same and not everyone thrives on attention from other people or gets energy from being around other people. Kevin liked reading and he liked playing chess. And according to Sports Illustrated, he used to go down, which I didn't realize was something that happened in America as well. Where they were living, I believe in LA at the time, there was like a little Greek community and he would go down and play with the old Greek guys. Now, that's something that happens in a neighborhood right near me in Melbourne, a very Greek neighborhood. They sit around, they play cards and chess all day. And when I went to Greece, I was like, oh my God, it's exactly like Oakley, which is right near me. And I love that that's something that happens, you know, wherever you are in the world. They just sit there all day outside like a taverna and play chess. But unfortunately, Kevin didn't really know who he was. And I think he went through his whole life not knowing who he was. And especially as Brian's star grew, Kevin felt more and more and more inadequate. He was also super sensitive throughout his life. When he was a child, he would cry very easily. And as an adult, as many very sensitive people do, but not all, Kevin would regularly turn to alcohol and he would have an issue with that throughout his adult life. He also had a knee-jerk anger, very short fuse, and he would explode with anger very easily. Brian, on the other hand, didn't seem to have that trait. Brian attended the University of Maryland on a basketball scholarship in 1987 at the age of 18, and after a year he transferred to the University of Arizona in Tucson. He played for two seasons there, and then in 1991, at the age of 21, he was drafted by the NBA to my team, Orlando Magic. And around this time, I was four, and this is when we were starting to watch basketball on the black and white TV. It was at this stage that Brian first battled clinical depression, and his team later on, the Pistons, would say that he was the first NBA player to actually publicly admit that he had mental health problems. His behavior was often erratic, and one time he passed out while guarding Shaq, while playing with Orlando Magic. Now, Shaq is probably Orlando's most famous ever player, and if you want to break the tension, pause this right now and Google Shaq, just write in Shaq and his girlfriend into Google and look at the picture of them coming out of a shop. He looks like he's got a toddler, but that's a fully grown woman. Shaq is massive, and he's also an incredible guy who regularly does amazing things for people around him and his community and doesn't ask for attention for it. Shout out to Shaq. According to Sports Illustrated, one night Brian took 15 sleeping pills, and they weren't sure still today whether or not this was what it was, a cry for help, a suicide attempt, or what. One time he crashed his car into a pole. He also openly said that he hated the city of Orlando, which is something I've heard quite a lot from people, and that he would he would say that basically since he was a kid, he'd been a vegetarian, and the exertion of being an NBA player and what you were putting out versus what he was putting in, he had like no iron in his system, and that basically messed with his energy levels and things. Now, while that could be true, that could have just been something he said, we don't know, but probably being a vegetarian probably isn't great for an athlete. When his team would chat together on planes and hang out and play cards on their private planes, Brian instead would read and sit in the corner. But his behaviour beyond that became more and more bizarre. According to NBA Insider, one time he tried to pull the emergency door open mid-flight at 30,000 feet while flying with his later team, the Chicago Bulls. And there was no explanation as to why he did this. It's almost like, you know, when you're driving and you suddenly feel like I could just veer off the road right now. And there's actually a term for that, that mental thing. You know not to do it, but you almost have an impulse to do it. But this is next level of that. And it almost sounds to me like Bison was on the precipice of some sort of breakdown. You can tell it like in his affect in interviews. You can also tell it just looking at pictures of him, and a lot of people commented on it in interviews that he did, or when his team won and everyone would be on the court celebrating, he looked disconnected from all of it. At this time, Brian met one of his good friends for life, and that would be a man named Patrick Byrne. These two were like chalk and cheese. Patrick is like a skinny, came from a rich family, skinny redhead, and Bison's, you know, 6'11", massive black guy. But they were best mates, and it was one of the people that Bison trusted with his life. When they became friends and Bison was already an NBA player, he didn't even tell Patrick that he was an NBA player for 2 months. And that seems to be a really common story with Bison. It just wasn't central to his life. He either didn't enjoy it, openly would admit he didn't enjoy it, or that it wasn't a passion of his. It was almost like he was doing it just as a means to make a lot of money, to put it away, and then to have to never think about it again. Patrick Byrne was an adventurer. At 21, he had been diagnosed with testicular cancer, which can be incredibly deadly, and it took 3 years for him to go into remission from treatment. As a result of this brush with death, Patrick lived his life large. He travelled anywhere and everywhere. He grabbed life by the balls. I wrote that and then I realised what I'd done. But yeah, that's what I'd call my memoir if I was Patrick Byrne, grabbing life by the balls. He got black belts in a bunch of martial arts, and he got a PhD from Stanford. Patrick and Brian were soul brothers. By this stage, Brian had developed a lifelong passion for travel and just seizing life, carpe diem. He ran with the Bulls in Pamplona. He would regularly visit a friend who lived in Beirut, Lebanon. At one point, he went during like a civil war there when the State Department said no tourists. He went anyway. He played multiple instruments. He loved poetry. He wasn't your typical NBA star. He was also highly intelligent, and he read some challenging texts, particularly by Nietzsche, who was his favourite. And even me, as a voracious reader, I've never even bothered to try to tackle Nietzsche. Together, these two young men skydived. They both earned their pilot's license. They would take a small Cessna out and land somewhere kind of wild, and they would sleep rough. They would go-karting. They would pretty much do all of this action-packed stuff together. Byrne said about Brian to Sports Illustrated, quote, "He was the coolest cat. Everyone wanted to hang out with him. You'd meet up and there was Eddie Vedder or Billy Corgan. Brian was so naturally cool. They all wanted to be around him," unquote. And if you don't know who those people are, Eddie Vedder's from Pearl Jam and Billy Corgan's from Smashing Pumpkins. This charisma also extended to women, although Bison doesn't seem to have taken much advantage of it because he wasn't, as he said, into groupies, which seems to be part and parcel of becoming famous in any aspect. Women will start kind of following you round. This is how Sports Illustrated put it. Quote, "Williams had a particularly powerful effect on women. Lithe and graceful, he appraised the world from behind those green eyes, mysterious and self-confident. Women left him envelopes on his front doorstep. 'Mr. Williams, you don't know me,' one read. I see you every day when you go to your car. I work in the hair salon nearby. I would do anything to spend one night with you. Anything. I've told my husband I don't care if he leaves me." Unquote. Byrne remembers watching William sort through the letters as most of us would the afternoon mail. Unquote. Amber Heard wrote that letter, just letting you know. Bison didn't like groupies, but he also wasn't really keen on getting into a romantic, serious relationship either. His career with Orlando ultimately ended up being really lackluster, to say the least, and he only played with them for one season. According to ESPN, one time, because he would read so much, he was reading near a teammate of his, and he was reading a biography of Miles Davis, who was, he's basically one of the greatest jazz musicians of all time. And he turned to his Orlando teammate, Tom Tolbert, and he said to Tom, quote, "I wish I had the passion for basketball that he did for music," unquote. Brian then went on to play for the Denver Nuggets for two seasons, which is my least favourite team name ever. With maturity and time to kind of grow up a little bit, so did Brian's skill. He then transferred to the LA Clippers for a year. But like John Brisker, who I covered way back on this podcast, Brian would never reach his full potential in the NBA. It was mainly contract disputes and Brian raising his price meant that after LA, the LA Clippers, nobody picked him up because of his price. And if you remember from the John Brisker episode, those who listened to it, John had a lot of erratic behavior on the court, assaulting teammates out of nowhere and things like that. And there's no evidence that Brian ever did that. His erratic behavior was kind of more internalized. Eventually, though, one of the biggest teams in America signed Brian. That would be the Chicago Bulls, where he would play 9 games. Sports Illustrated painted a picture of this time. Quote, "It is June 13th, 1997, and the United Center in Chicago is a cauldron of joy. The Bulls had just won the NBA championship, their 5th in 7 years, in an epic series against the Utah Jazz that included 2 last-second game winners and a remarkable flu-ridden performance in Game 5 by Michael Jordan. Now the team gathers on a portable stage erected on a parquet. Red and white confetti drifts down and 24,000 Chicago fans roar. In the midst of it all is Jordan, hugging his finals MVP trophy and grinning, a flake of red tinsel stuck to his right temple. To his left is coach Phil Jackson, bushy head and bearded, and next to him, Scottie Pippen. Not far back is Dennis Rodman, scalp the colour of a child's finger painting, and Steve Kerr, holding his son on his shoulders. But the player closest to Jordan, the one standing just to his right, is Brian Williams, the Bulls' 6'10" forward center. The two men had become friends after the Bulls signed Williams as a free agent that April. Jordan pushed him to get in shape, to maximize his talent, to truly care about the game. Williams responded. He played a key role in the Bulls' championship run, logging nearly as many minutes as starting center Luke Longley. Kerr says the team wouldn't have won the series without Williams, unquote. Now, when I was watching this video by NBA Insider, which is on YouTube, it's to be fair, they do a better job than most people covering the story. It goes for about half an hour. But basically a lot of big basketball fans comment, you know, and there's a lot said about Michael Jordan being a sociopath, and people have kind of tested him and he tests very high for sociopathy. And that's probably why he excelled at what he did in his career. But a lot of people say behind closed doors, he's a real kind of wolf in sheep's clothing. And someone wrote about how he often pretended to befriend you or whatever, but once you're out of his line of vision, even as a teammate, he never really gave you a look in again, never really followed up with you, which sucks, because I know Michael Jordan's had some tragedy in his life, but never once after Bison Daly went missing did Michael Jordan ever speak about it or try to raise awareness of it. None of these people really did. The only person who did really speak about it were his immediate close friends who weren't NBA players, and Steve Kerr, who was quoted in that piece. Steve Kerr said that he had like the best talent he'd ever seen in a young player, and he really thought that he'd go further than what his career did. But I didn't watch the Michael Jordan documentary that came out. I don't really want to. I don't really care. But I'm just saying, like, he kind of used people at the time for what he could get them for, and that's kind of generally what most people were talking about in the comments. You couldn't expect Michael Jordan to care about what happened to Bison Delly because he's kind of a minion to him. Ultimately, though, Bryan Williams would go on to play two seasons with the Detroit Pistons, so he's moving around a fair bit. He actually became their highest paid player. And when he got his playoff share for, I guess, making the playoffs, he actually didn't want it. He asked the Pistons if instead they could split his sizable share, which they didn't say what it was, but I believe it was a fair amount of money, to give it to the janitors, ball boys, and trainers, and to split it evenly amongst them. He was incredibly gifted, and I honestly think money was just another perk. You know, he wasn't like a Michael Jordan or a Kobe. He didn't want to be the best. I think he just wanted to get in, get what he could, and get out. Here's Bison speaking before a game in May 1999.
Certainly adds that extra dimension. You know, it just gives us a lot of depth too. Doesn't inhibit us so much with fouls. Without fouls, it really changed the complexion of the game.
Bison, you've played on some pretty darn good teams. You won a championship when you're here in Chicago. You guys are really starting to play some good basketball. Detroit now, you won six in a row. How is this team shaping up? Does it have what it takes to go far in the playoffs?
Yeah, it does. It does. And, you know, it's just the rhythm of, you know, how you get to into the playoffs. And, you know, we just want to keep it rolling.
You played with Michael, of course. You played with Scotty. Any similarities between what you've seen with Joe Dumars being his teammate now for 2 years and some of the things that the greater players like Michael Jordan, Scotty Pippen used to do when you played with them?
Say that again?
Any similarities between like a Michael Jordan, Joe Dumars, the way they carry themselves, the way that... your thoughts on Joe, I guess. He did his last game here in Chicago.
Oh, yeah, that's right. The
There's a theme here.
Well, considering the fact that he's done it all, seen it all.
Hey, Rory, I think I saw him leave.
He's just, he knows really how to handle himself. He knows, you know, what to say when to the team. We love his leadership. We love his presence. And, he can still light it up. So I don't really like comparing players because it's like snowflakes. They're all unique, different. There's not in the history of the world never been two snowflakes alike, so certainly not going to be two players alike. And Joe's just great in his own way. I love him.
That's Bison Dealey here in the Bulls locker, or I'm sorry, Pistons locker room. Bison a couple years ago on the all-interview team. Say they didn't ask the right questions. So go back to Chet and Norm.
After that, they, like, go back to the studio and they're, like, throwing shade on him. Clearly didn't ask the right questions and stuff. That's what they're saying. Because he's, if you watch that interview, he's not really paying attention to what the guy's saying. He's very, like, thoughtful when he does. But at one point, the guy asks a question. He's clearly just away with the fairies. And when you start to kind of look into what he was going through, probably what he, the fact that he was kind of tapped out with basketball in general, and he was probably over it at this stage. You can see why people would think he was aloof, which a lot of people did, or a bit strange. But I honestly just think his heart wasn't in it. And he had like a flat affect, which you can compare it to earlier ones even, where it's a bit more upbeat, that he's just kind of over it. And that he was gearing up for leaving the NBA. And you kind of get the feeling as well that he didn't just play the game, not just the game of basketball, but you got to play the game in terms of talking to interviewers and doing all that other stuff, your sponsorship stuff and all of that. And that's all additional stuff that I know a lot of sports people struggle with. Like, a lot of actors don't like doing press for their movies, but it's part of the contractual stuff. In 1998, just before he turned 30, Brian Williams officially changed his name to Bison Deli to honour both his Native American Cherokee ancestry as well as his African ancestry. And he played his final season under that name. Now, if you're wondering where it comes from, bison is very important to the Native Americans. I looked this up, and basically, according to the National Park Service, they had an interesting paragraph that gave me quite a lot about how important the bison is to many different tribes. Quote, the American bison or buffalo in Niwa, in Blackfoot, Tatanka in Lakota, Ivanbito in Navajo, and Kutz in Paiute is the most significant animal to many American Indian nations. For thousands of years, Native Americans relied heavily on bison for their survival and well-being, using every part of the bison for food, clothing, shelter, tools, jewelry, and in ceremonies. The decimation of millions of bison in the 1800s was pivotal in the tragic devastation of Indian people and society. Today, bison are central to many American Indian traditions, spiritual rituals, and healthy diets, and more than 60 tribes are bringing their sacred brother buffalo back to their families, lands, and way of life, unquote, which I found that's a really, you know, strong name when you consider the significance of the name. I'm really into what names mean and how people kind of become their names almost. Deli, the surname, or Dealey, as that guy said, or however it is, it's probably Dele in French. Dele, I looked up, and Dele is actually a Nigerian given name and surname there. In the Yoruba language in Nigeria, it literally means, quote unquote, come home. And Dele was actually the name of one of the Williams family's first ancestors on the mother's side, who was bought out as a slave, I believe, to the United States. So that's how he got Bison Deli or Dealey or Daily. So I found that really interesting. Now, I also went back and looked to see when John Brisker started making these changes to his life on that episode, in terms of he hadn't quite changed his name, but he, if you remember, he started being interested in Uganda, which is where his ancestors had come from. And he regularly wore dashikis. Suddenly he started wearing them. He listened to African music. He read a lot of books about Uganda and Africa. And then he would ultimately go there and go missing under when Idi Amin was, you know, ruling Uganda. And I found it astounding that both Brian Williams made this decision to change his name and John Brisker started making these major life decisions, both at the age of 30. And I don't know if that's a coming of age thing for men. I'm interested to see what people think about that, kind of what happens at 30 as a man, especially when you're kind of looking into ancestry. If anyone wants to contact me if they have a story or anything like that. Now, at this same time, Kevin Williams, Bison's brother, changed his name, which right after Bison did, which I find strange to do immediately after your brother's done it. He changed his name from Kevin Williams to Miles Debord. Now, Deli and Debord are both French in ancestry, so I found that a very strange thing to do. Now, the reason that Kevin took these two names was because he took the Miles from Miles Davis, who, as I talked about earlier, Brian really appreciated and respected and read books about. So I found that interesting, but he had a lot of followers, so maybe it's not totally weird. And he took the surname also from an ancestor, Debord. And I just find that a very weird thing to do right off the back of your brother doing it. Now, a lot of people say that Kevin wanted to be Brian, and I'm sympathetic to Kevin in a lot of aspects of his life, believe me. I'm unsympathetic to him in a lot of them. And this is one where someone wrote he literally wanted to be his brother. And I find this part where he changed his name using the exact same way kind of that Bison did a little bit strange. But from now on, I'm going to be referring to them as Bison and Miles. So Brian, around this time, was known to date a few celebrities, including Sports Illustrated models and Madonna. Madonna went out with everyone, though, so it's not totally weird. According to Sports Illustrated, though, this fizzled out really quickly because, surprise, surprise, Bison said Madonna was self-absorbed. Can you believe it? Now, when she would call Bison, she would talk for 30 minutes and he wouldn't be able to get a word in, to the point where he would either put the phone down or hand it to a friend of his, like Patrick Byrne. And she wouldn't even take a breath and just talk about herself for 30 minutes and not notice he was on the phone. Now, that is not a shock to me, nor should that be a shock to you. So that did not last very long. Meanwhile, his brother Miles was working as a freelance computer guy. That's kind of what they say. I don't know what it was back then. He was probably like a freelance computer expert, fixing them and things like that. He went from job to job and apartment to apartment. And meanwhile, his brother was this high, you know, the most highly paid NBA player on the Detroit Pistons. He was going out with celebrities. He had a ton of money. He had $35 million on his contract still. Meanwhile, his brother is just floundering. And his brother is older than him at this point. So Miles probably felt inferior, feeling like he should be ahead of his brother by now because, you know, he's 3 years older. But when times got tough, he had no issue on turning up on Bison's doorstep or taking money from him. There didn't seem to be a whole lot of pride in regards to Miles trying to make it on his own. He would put his hand out. According to ESPN, quote, he had a history of reappearing in his brother's life when his financial conditions demanded it, unquote, which, yeah, that's my life as well with one of my brothers. Then you don't hear from them for ages. When you do hear from them, they don't ask how you are. They're there for a purpose. And that's pretty much it. Don't hear from them when your life's tough, but they'll definitely appear when their life is tough. According to Sports Illustrated, every few months, Miles would contact Bison with a new get-rich-quick scheme that he'd come up with, and he wanted money to put into that. And Bison would humour him for a number of years. He would give him a lot of money, money in amounts that should have been enough to get a normal person on their feet in the late 90s, early 2000s. But Miles was clearly, to me, just squandering it away. As his career grew, so did the expectation that Bison would financially help out his family. He paid for his mum to go back to college. He paid upfront for her entire tuition, which was $80,000, and he bought her a house as well. He gave Miles $50,000 on two separate occasions, just a couple of years apart. By this stage, their father, Gino, was a lounge singer in Vegas, washed up with a cocaine problem. But one of the saddest things in this that just made me realize why Bison decided to estrange himself from his family and started to think maybe I'm being used here and they don't care about me, they only care about what I financially can give them, was this story. He would regularly try to help his dad out or do nice things for him, you know, because he was in a lounge in Vegas, probably during the day, some sad lounge, doing cocaine. And he thought he was going to buy his dad. He got a $25,000 bonus for something regarding the Detroit Pistons. And he took $15,000 of it and he presented his dad in person. Patrick Byrne was there with a $15,000 brand new Harley Davidson. He thought it would make his dad's life. Patrick Byrne was there for this touching moment. He told Sports Illustrated that Gino looked at the bike for a long time, turned to Bison and said, "Son, next time just give me the cash," unquote. It's shit like this that you understand why Bison again and again tried to cut his family off, and I totally get it. I felt so pissed off just reading that little story from Patrick Byrne that he's around to tell us that that happened. So then the writer of the ESPN article kind of paints a picture of this, all of this without backstory, but instead just jumps to the fact that Bison was an aloof asshole who was estranged from his family. But thank God for Sports Illustrated, I never thought I'd say that, because this is why it's so important to look at different sources for your information. And I've looked at a large number of them for this. But Sports Illustrated uses citations, which ESPN does not, and paints a backstory as to why this happened. So if you just went off the ESPN article, you'd just think he was an asshole, he didn't want to help his family. Once you look at the Sports Illustrated, you know, pages long feature story that they did where they spoke to family, friends, everything, it paints this backstory that you need to evaluate the whole situation. So he would regularly write check after check for his brother and his family, and ultimately around the age of 30, Bison would become estranged from his mother, which they don't really get into why. And around the same time, Miles did as well. When he disappeared, Bison had not spoken to his mum for, I think, about 3 years. But no matter how much Bison wrote check after check, Miles would not try to get it together at all. It seemed that he always knew he had this fallback with his brother, and as a result, it's pretty hard to get your ass into gear when you're not a motivated person. Their mother, Patricia, told the LA Times in late 2002, quote, "People always gravitated to Brian, even before he became a celebrity. Miles is studious and quiet. He grew up in his brother's shadow. Everything that happened to Brian was so much bigger than what happened in Miles's life. I think that manifested in Miles to the point where he was telling himself, my mother doesn't love me and she never will," unquote. Now, one of the things I found interesting in that quote from the mum was that she is happy to use Kevin's new name, Miles, which he's had by this point for years, but Brian has had the name Bison for even longer than that, and she doesn't refer to him as Bison, she refers to him as Brian, and maybe that's another reason why he wasn't interested in talking to her. But actually, at this stage, both brothers were ultimately had wiped their mother for years. So when she's saying that quote, she's looking back over years ago because she hadn't seen them for 3 years for Bison and 4 years for Miles. From the time they met in college, Bison and his close friend Kevin Porter were really tight. Yes, another Kevin, but this is actual Kevin. When Bison went pro in the NBA, he hired Kevin as his business manager. He trusted Kevin with his life, unlike his brother Kevin, later Miles. Kevin oversaw Bison's finances, and if you just look at the ESPN article, you would think that he is the savior of Bison's life. He's the best friend you'd ever have. But when you look over and look at other articles, including Sports Illustrated, they discuss how people later on would tell the FBI that Kevin Porter was Bison's quote-unquote gopher, so he would just do things for Bison. And they would also imply that he was writing checks for himself out of Bison's money as well. Now, ESPN does not ever reference that, but at one point, Sports Illustrated talks about how Bison basically said he was cutting off his brother financially, no more checks, and also to cut off Kevin Porter financially as well. But because Kevin Porter is the main person interviewed for ESPN, this is missing from that. And because Patrick Byrne is the main person interviewed for Sports Illustrated, you get another side to the story, if you get what I mean. But Kevin Porter told ESPN in 2002 that the brothers' relationship was categorized by, quote, small verbal altercations. They were always out to establish who was the alpha, who was the top dog, unquote. And I saw someone refer to it as bickering, which I think is probably spot on. No massive kind of punch-ons or anything like that. Just bickering at each other. which women do a lot, but men do just as much. Now, later on, when Bison would go missing, Kevin Porter really would try to get answers for his friend, and I do firmly believe that. ESPN referred to him as, quote, a burly fireplug of a man, unquote. I'll talk about them and the investigation more in part two. At 30, Bison shocked a lot of people by retiring from the NBA. Many considered him in the peak of his career and they begged for him to reconsider. He walked away from $35 million left on his contract and like 5 years left. At one point, his manager emailed him and said that the Lakers wanted to sign him. He didn't even reply to the email. He read it but didn't reply. He just was not interested. And he would regularly do that with people, or he would reply a really weird, like one word or a quote from a book or something like that, which would really start to annoy me, to be honest. Like John Brisker, it seems that Bison's career was marred by bad relationships with the teams that he played for, but it seems that he was probably the instigator of these bad relationships and that people really did try to get the best out of him and to give him the best possible career. But he probably wasn't as fiery and he didn't have the explosive anger that John Brisker had. Bison ended up walking away from this massive contract rather than to be traded. He had made enough money to make himself comfortable, and many believed Bison's heart was just never in the game. After retirement, Bison found a true love of traveling. He didn't even have a home. He just took off with a backpack and he could live really rough with next to nothing. He actually came out here and lived in the Australian outback for ages, like months and months in the middle of nowhere, sleeping in the back of a ute, which is like a utility vehicle, with a friend of his. He would meet other travelers along the way and start traveling with them, things like that. He'd go surfing and exploring. He would travel to Europe. He would go jet skiing in the Mediterranean. He traveled through India and Indonesia by himself. He spent several months back in Beirut, Lebanon again, where his friend owned a water purification plant, and Bison actually bought a share in it. He DJed in nightclubs there. He really liked it in Lebanon. Bison was really low maintenance and he just wanted to live his life with no hassle, no stress, people not asking him for stuff. He didn't have a fixed address. He just had a lot of money and all the time in the world. But according to some of Bison's friends, it wasn't all a dream existence. His friend who lived in Beirut, Hosseini, contacted Patrick Byrne in the year 2000 to advise him that he was concerned for Bison's well-being. At this point, Bison was smoking a lot of marijuana and his erratic behaviour had become a little bit more erratic. On top of chasing really young women because he wasn't interested in a long-term relationship, Patrick Byrne refers to basically how Hosseini referred to Bison's behaviour in Beirut as Kurtz-like. Now, the Sean Flynn, Dana Stone episode, I talked about the book Heart of Darkness, which Apocalypse Now was based on. And Colonel Kurtz was the character who, in Heart of Darkness, went out into the Congo, basically deserted his unit, went rogue and set himself up as like a little king in this village in the Congo. Now that's set in like the 1900s. Apocalypse Now, they have Marlon Brando playing the part of Kurtz, but this time it's set in Vietnam because they did that to make it a bit more modern. And basically, I don't remember if it's in the Apocalypse Now one, but in Heart of Darkness, in the book by Joseph Conrad, Colonel Kurtz basically kills local people, lives in his own little wilderness, has completely lost track of reality, and he's got the severed heads of the native people on sticks all around, like his hut that he's living in. And it's this search for Colonel Kurtz, which is Apocalypse Now. Dennis Hopper, I believe, goes and looks for Marlon Brando and finds him. And he's basically lost touch with reality and doesn't know who he is anymore. But once upon a time, he was like an upstanding military man. Now, the term Kurtz-like was kind of chilling for me to read because when they give a few examples, they basically say that Bison had kind of this weird charismatic thing where when he'd arrive in like a village, people would come out and start drumming, and it was really strange. And I've got a quote coming up, like he would draw people in almost, but also they're referring to the fact that he is living on in isolated areas, being isolated, and too much in his head, basically. But he's kind of like what Errol Flynn wanted to be in all of his stories that he made up, but he wasn't. So meanwhile, his brother Miles also wanted to be left alone, but in a different way. I believe that these kind of traits are genetic, and I have personal experience in that. And no matter how much you try to kind of veer away from who you are at your core, especially when you've got like a close sibling or you've had similar experiences growing up, you're very similar genetically, but also, you know, environmentally, and that stuff kind of sets you on a path for the rest of your life. And even if you veer away from it, those things will always be there kind of joining you. Miles always wanted to live off the grid, but this was from a sense of inadequacy, unlike it seems like with Bison, especially at the peak of Bison's fame. The two men were polar opposites but near identical, with Sports Illustrated calling Miles, quote, the thicker, less handsome version of Bison, unquote, which if you look up pictures of them, I'll put a picture of both of them at the same time in their lives, basically. It's you can't put it any other way, but you can tell they're brothers. Miles had also dealt with depression throughout his life, and he'd attempted suicide as well before. According to a close friend of both men felt voids inside that just could not be filled, not by travel, material things, relationships, jobs, money, anything. Miles knew that he could always turn to help from his little brother Bison, but the tap would be turned off after Bison's retirement and the handouts would end. He told Patrick Byrne to screen any communications from Miles and to say no to any loans or handouts because they weren't really loans. He also said to say no to Kevin Porter too, according to Patrick Byrne. In the year 2000, Bison decided to tick the next big thing off his bucket list that he'd always wanted to do, learning to sail. But he didn't just learn to sail on any little boat. He bought a 50-foot-long catamaran for $650,000, which was probably chump change to him at the time. And he christened it Hakuna Matata, which, by the way, that means no worries for the rest of your days. I don't know where he bought it, but I kind of get the feeling he bought it in Australia because he set out from Australia in it. And he learned to sail it. Its hull was made of fiberglass and reinforced plastic, and inside was like a sprawling house. Multiple bedrooms, a big kitchen, a living area with all the home comforts and, you know, sound system and TV. Sports Illustrated put it like this, quote, with a rotating cast of captains, mates and travel partners, Williams sailed the South Pacific from Australia to Papua New Guinea to the small island of Vanuatu. Stories filtered out how he'd dock in a small port, go ashore, and a whole village would come out and jam with him around the fire. How he'd project Bob Marley concert films onto the jib and canoes would line up behind to watch, unquote. Now that to me sounds like an Errol Flynn type story. It all sounds a bit fanciful, these kinds of stories. I'd take them with a grain of salt. But I mean, if he lied about that, that's the least of what's to come. Bison had always said that he, at this stage in his life, wasn't ready for a long-term relationship or anything serious, and no one really turned his head, except a woman would come along who would. And that woman was a young woman called Serena Carlin. Serena Carlin was introduced to Bison Daly by his business manager, Kevin Porter, in 1997. At the time, she was 25, he was about 28, and she was rooming with one of his high school roommates. One night, the whole group went out and they saw a concert together. And on the way home, Serena turned to Bison and she asked him, have you ever been in a crowded room and felt like you were the only one there? And he was really shocked by this, you know, admission. And he replied, yes, like he understood exactly what she meant. Serena is often painted as a secondary figure in the story, and I'd never really knew anything about her in other coverage, so I'm just so glad that Sports Illustrated talked about her. Serena Midnight Carlin was born on April 4th, 1972, 2 days before Bison's third birthday. She was born in New York City to some pretty eccentric parents. And I'm going to try not to laugh when I say the next thing, and there's a reason that I laugh. At her birth, there were 30 people in the room, and they were all meditating and playing music while she was being given birth to by her mum, Gail. Her head crowned 2 minutes before midnight, hence her middle name, Midnight. Now, if you've ever... All right, guys, I collected myself. Now, I just have to explain the reason I laugh, because if you've ever watched the amazing British show Absolutely Fabulous, which is a show I know off by heart, sadly, there is an episode where they talk about their childhoods and they have flashbacks to Patsy and Adina, the two main characters, their births and how different they were. And when they flash back to Patsy's, they have her mum giving birth, and in the background there's people doing yoga because she was a real hippie. There's a French poet. There's a painter. There's people. It's out of control. It is so funny. There's about 50 people in the room all doing different stuff. So when she gives birth to Patsy, because you don't know until this point her name's not Patsy Stone, her mum makes no noise doing it, and then she holds the baby up and she announces Patsy's name. Now, I won't ruin it for you, but it's about 50 different names and they're all very hippy dippy names like Eurydice and Clytemnestra and all this stuff. And then at the end she says Patricia Stone. I don't know. It's identical. It's almost like they took it from AbFab, that story, or AbFab took it from this family. Either way, it was an amazing, like, breakup of tension for me reading that. But I love the family already. From a young age, Serena was extremely spiritual and thoughtful and mature for her age. And this is probably down to the fact that when she was one, her parents split. And she was raised by her mum, Gail, in the city of Berkeley, California, up near San Francisco. Her mum would remarry her stepdad, Scott, who later on would be very instrumental in trying to find answers as to what happened to his daughter and Bison. Serena took that kind of hippy-dippy stuff through life. She believed in fate and soulmates and twin flames. And she was really empathetic and she really listened to what you had to say. And she could have really deep conversations for hours and hours with just random people. And you can see why after dating Madonna, Bison was probably attracted to that. Now, she was also incredibly physically beautiful. She had dark, short, dark hair, but these brilliant, crystal clear blue eyes, almost very similar to Bison's. And she was just beautiful, really photogenic. And there's quite a few pictures of her that you can find. But she was sick of men just wanting her for her looks. And she was always looking for that soulmate who would see her for who she was inside. Later, when her daughter and her daughter's boyfriend would go missing, it seems to me, according to the ESPN article, that Gail very quickly gave up the search. It was probably too overwhelming for her. ESPN said that she, quote unquote, wanted peace by early 2002, late 2002. And this is only months after the two went missing. It made me kind of sad, you know, because it was Serena's stepdad, Scott, that set up a website and was trying to get answers. And he set up like a whole kind of center in their house with hotlines and phone calls and things, but Gail seemed to have just completely disconnected from the whole thing. Despite their brief connection in 1997, at the time it was not good timing for Serena and Bison. Bison was all over the place with different teams, moving around, touring, and he was not a one-woman man, and Serena moved on. She worked in retail, which she hated, word, and one night she was in an LA nightclub and fate kind of intervened. The singer Prince was there, as is every time any of us go to a nightclub. Late singer, RIP. And he called her over to his table after seeing her. And they started talking. It was nothing kind of sexual. And they stayed in touch. And a few years later, he offered her a job as his personal assistant, and she took it. Now, Prince had a girlfriend at the time. They don't say which one it was, but I believe it was probably that model, Maita, or however you say her name. And Serena felt like she took on more of a role of looking after the girlfriend and mothering her, which is kind of weird when you're only in your late 20s and this woman is an adult. Eventually, Serena realized that being Prince's personal assistant was not what she wanted, despite it being a good opportunity. Pretty cool thing to have on your resume, and she resigned. She and Bison, about once a year, would connect, you know, just ships in the night. Her friends commented on how Serena was all kind of pleased that a man like Bison wanted her for more than her looks, and she really wasn't fussed or bowled over by the whole NBA thing, that she didn't really care that he was famous. Sometimes he would be emotionally unavailable and switched off, which I think is most men at that age, and he never discussed his family to Serena ever. They just weren't a part of his life. But then Bison retired and he went MIA on his travels through the world for ages, and Serena's life went on. She moved coasts, this time to New York City from LA. She was 30 by this time, or nearing 30, and she started working as a real estate broker, but she hated that too. According to friends, she just couldn't find the right thing for her, and it was just frustrating. You know, everything felt like a wrong fit. Similar to Bison, you know, and similar to his brother, I guess, in a way, and similar to many of us listening. Then 9/11 happened, and Serena, living in New York City and having been born there, was obviously shaken by this event, like so many. And 9/11 wasn't just a turning point for so many people in their lives, but it would actually lead Serena, you know, to make this decision that would be a very fateful decision. Bison reached out to her knowing she was now living in New York City, and he was worried about her. And he asked her to leave New York and to join him on his catamaran, where he was flitting between islands in the South Pacific at this time. New York City was a depressing place, obviously, at this point, and she hated her job, and she still had to keep her job, unfortunately, because she had debts and she had bills and she was living in one of the most expensive cities in the world. But he told her, don't worry, just come out for 2 weeks for a holiday. You need it. Don't have to pay for anything. You'll have an amazing time. So Serena tossed it over with her mom and her stepdad and her friends, and they really encouraged her to go and have a break. They never met Bison and they never would, but all they knew was that their daughter had for years on and off known this NBA player, and he was now living on this massive catamaran in the South Pacific, and, you know, why not? She spent 2 weeks on Bison's boat, and that 2 weeks became 5 weeks. I don't know if by this point she had a job to return to. It seems like a lot of time to take off, or just to keep ringing your boss and telling them you'll be back next week. So finally, she did fly home after 5 weeks, and she had had an amazing time. Serena told her mum that it was the best trip ever. But she also said she didn't think that it had the makings of a serious relationship, despite how well they clicked and everything. She said she kind of suspected that Brian was a bit of a commitment phobe, and she just wasn't sure about where his head was at. 2 weeks later, Brian popped up in her DMs, or whatever the year 2000 equivalent of the DMs were, AOL, ICQ, I don't know, MSN Messenger. And he asked her, could she please come back out? Bear in mind, she'd just flown back to the States from the South Pacific 2 weeks before. She said to him, look, I have bills and stuff to pay. I can't just keep going out there. You know, I live in New York City. And that was the end of that. A few days later, a small package arrived via courier. And inside that package was a note and a check for $50,000. The accompanying note read, quote, this is what I think of your financial situation, unquote. This was obviously from Bison. He asked her in the accompanying note to not just come out for a holiday, but to come out permanently to live with him on his catamaran. Seemingly, the guy who didn't want to be tied down by anyone had met the woman for him. And a lot of people will go, oh, a man can't just buy a woman, yada, yada. I love this note that he sent, and $50,000 was nothing to him. He probably loved her company and he wanted her back. And I just love the whole thing about what he did. I love the note he sent. He's basically saying, this will pay for everything. This will take your mind off it. Come and do this. She could have easily torn it up. You know, she's a woman in her own right. But I think he knew, you know, that she wanted to come out. And I think that's kind of the extent of how romantic he was going to be. He's not throwing his money around or anything like that or showing off. He's just saying, here's the answer, you know. Serena's family told her to go, you know, it's an incredible opportunity. She wasn't happy in her life and, you know, this guy, he had so much money. It would have been nothing to him for her to, you know, live with him on this catamaran or to give her life up and leave. And she knew that if she didn't go, she would always be living with those what ifs, which to me are worse than regrets of things that you did. It's worse to always wonder, what if I'd done this? So at the beginning of 2002, Serena flew out to meet Bison in New Zealand. She was the happiest she had ever been, and they would board the catamaran for what would seemingly be an amazing life together. But soon a black cloud would roll over their dream reunion in the sunny shoals of French Polynesia. And that's where I will leave it for part one, and I'll be back with part two next week. I hope that you're enjoying this. If you don't know the story, try not to look it up because you probably can't guess where it goes, actually. Even if you think you can, you can't. I will be back. The website's down just this week. I'll try to get it back up tomorrow. Become a patron. It links off the website, which isn't up, Felicity. Just go on the Patreon app and search, or search for Unknown Passage in Google. Leave a rating or review if you like the show. On Spotify, you can leave your little star things now, but I can't find it on the desktop version. I can only find it on the phone version. I don't like Spotify desktop. I can't work out how to use it ever. If you want to give a donation to the PayPal, it is unknownpassagepodcast@gmail.com. Currently, I'm not taking any case requests or anything via email. People send them through all the time. I've got the next like year planned and I just can't take on any more. I've got about 800 cases on my list to do. So at the moment, and I've put it on the website, I'm not taking requests. I'm sorry about that. If you do email them, I'll just say, you know, I'll reply, thanks, you know, I'll add it to the list, but I probably won't get to it because there's a lot I want to get to. I will be back with part two and we'll see where the story of Bison and Serena goes. Have a great rest of your weekend. Bye.